Do you just love this podcast so much and wish you could find a way to monetarily support us? Well, guess what? Much like NPR, we thrive on support from viewers like you. So if you love this podcast and you want to become a contributor, all you have to do is go to anchor.fm. That's ANCHOR.FM. Click the support button and choose the amount that you want to contribute each month to our podcast. This helps keep our podcast going, and it keeps the phenomenal content that you have come to know and love flowing. So yeah, what are you waiting for? Sign up today. As always, thank you so much for being a listener. We appreciate you, we see you, and we hope you enjoy the show. Spoiler alert. If you do not want this film ruined, do not proceed. There's spoilers galore. You have been warned. Welcome to Talk Classic to Me, the classic film podcast and movie club where I, Sarah Greenfield, your host and classic film enthusiast, bring in my entertaining friends to talk about classic movies or any other old-fashioned form of media that strikes my fancy. On today's show, we're talking about the film A Hard Day's Night from 1964 with my wonderful guests, Jason Burke and Sarah Royce. Welcome to Talk Classic to Me. I am your host, Sarah Greenfield. And today on the show, I have two wonderful guests, Jason Burke and Sarah Royce. Hello, friends. Thanks for being here.
Hello.
Thank you so much for having me.
So today we're going to talk about the film A Hard Day's Night from 1964. This is the Beatles classic. How was this viewing for you guys? Was it good?
I basically found out that I can never watch this movie with other people because I will talk all the way through it. Sarah, I can basically quote this entire movie. And I was, but I watched it.
I can do that with Newsies. I don't know what that tells you about me. Jason, how about you?
I feel that because I definitely have the tendency to watch other people watch this movie. Mm. If they like aren't somebody that is, you know, as versed as, like, I've got a whole Beatles group chat that if we were all watching, yeah, it'd be great. But for people, I'm like, no, like you like there's all these like weird nuances and little jokes. You have to like watch it. I had a blast though.
So I'm really glad that you're both on the show because I love the Beatles. I think they're great. I've listened to all their albums, but I don't know that much about them. You're both like Beatles experts, super fans. So that is why you are both on the show today. And the reason that I chose this is because I wanted to talk about the Beatles on the show. We haven't really done like a Beatles film or a film like this before. But if I'm being very honest, this is not my favorite Beatles film. I prefer Help. When I was a little kid, that was one of the movies we'd rent when we were sick. And it was really colorful and fun and weird. And Ringo had a very large part. And there was a tiger and, you know, a cult and sacrificing, you know, things like that just for children. But I always enjoyed that more when I was little. And this movie, I don't know. Maybe, I don't know. I don't love it, I think, as much as you guys do. I'm sorry.
Not because it's in black and white, is it? Was that a problem for you when you were
a kid? When I was a kid, it was a problem. But yeah. Also, I just didn't like it as much. It doesn't have a plot, really. And so when you're a kid, you're like, I don't care. Give me the tiger and John fishing glasses out of soup. Like,
As a kid, I was the exact same way. I was like, yeah, Hard Day's Night, that's the boring one. That's the, like, I didn't realize, oh, there are jokes here. This is funny. Help as a kid. I was like, yeah, this is the, like, the cartoony, goofy one. I did watch Help within the last year. It mm-hmm. is still a lot of fun. I don't think it's necessarily as good of a movie.
So adult Sarah might not like Help the way that kid Sarah liked Help, because it's been so long since I've seen it that this fond memory might be destroyed. And I might be like, oh, Hard Day's Night is so much better. I just don't know because I haven't watched in a while. That's what we're saying.
Yeah, that's the assumption.
Got it.
So I watched both of these as an adult. I didn't become a Beatles fan until I was like 17, 18 years old. So I had no experience as a kid being like, oh, I don't want to watch the black and white one. I want to watch the one with the cult, the weird cult in it, and the lady from A Little Princess.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I mean, this has always been my favorite over Help, over Yellow Submarine.
All right. Well, I'm going to do a plot synopsis for people at home who might not have seen it. So this movie, A Hard Day's Night, is basically like The Beatles, the movie. And it's shot like black and white, cinema verite style. For the time, it's like very fresh, very new, very modern. And it's very surprisingly funny and
there's a lot of humor in it, and it's supposed to kind of mock the Beatles' fame, like how much their lives have changed. They have hordes of screaming fans following them wherever they go. They're trying to escape them. They're bombarded by ridiculous questions from reporters all the time. They respond with humor. It kind of shows the negative side of fame, but in a funny way. And then you get all of their music. It's like pre-music video. Like before there was MTV, there were movies that bands did where they played their music for you and they would play the same song several times because it was the past and you couldn't rewatch and record it. You had to go to the movie theater to see it. So I feel like that's kind of what this movie is. Oh, and there's like a plot too where there's Paul, you know, the four Beatles, everybody at home, you know them, John Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, and Ringo Starr, aka Richard Starkey. We all know them. But they are playing themselves, and Paul has a very evil and mischievous grandpa, who is his granddad, because he's entitled to two. And his grandpa's terrible. I hate him and think he's a total villain. And he's always stirring up trouble. And there's a part where he makes Ringo feel like he's not really part of the group. And Ringo goes off on a parade. That's what they call it. He goes parading. He jaunts off on his own. And then he ends up in jail. And then he gets out of jail. And then he comes back to the Beatles, and then they perform on television. And that's A Hard Day's Night, the film. So let's jump in. My two Beatles experts, like, do you want to share why this movie's important?
Yeah, I mean, this is like, it's Beatlemania. It's all the madness of Beatlemania, screaming fans wherever they went. No privacy, no, like, freedom. But in a fun way, you know.
They never look sad about it, but you're like, oh.
But also this movie is so much better than it has any right to be. Like the producers totally expected that this would just, I mean, it was a cash grab. It was a total cash grab. They were like, we have this band. They're really popular right now. So as soon as we humanly can, let's write a movie, shoot it, edit it, and like put it in theaters. And even if it bombs, at least we'll have a soundtrack that the kids will probably still buy. So like this, they shot this movie in like 6.5 weeks, in like from March to April of 1964. The movie came out in July. Like it was like fast. Cause they were like, cause one of the things that they kept on getting asked in press conferences is, you know, what will you do when the bubble bursts? Cause everyone saw all this madness going on and they're like, there's no way that this level of hype can be maintained for very long. The bubble is going to burst. These guys are going to go away and the next big thing is going to come along. So like the bubble will burst. And so we have to make this movie before that happens so we can maybe get some money.
Well, and I'm wondering, do you think this movie is as good as it is because the Beatles were allowed to choose who wrote it and who directed it? Like they had a lot of creative decisions that they were allowed to make, which I don't know if people today would be allowed to have those same creative decisions. Oh, and I should mention people at home. The director is Richard Lester and the writer of the film is Alan Owen.
I think they weren't savvy enough necessarily to look at the team and go like, we need to assemble the team to really give us a quality product. But they chose Richard Lester to direct because of his association with the Goons, the Goon show, Peter Sellers. Richard Lester had directed the Running, Jumping, and Standing Still film, which if you watch the Can't Buy Me Love sequence is like, that's, they're like, we want to do that. We want to do just goofy kind of speed up the footage a little bit, do goofy camera tricks. But it was just because they're like, well, he worked with people that we love, so let's work with them. The same way that when they first got in the recording studio, they were working with George Martin, who had also produced records for the Goons. And it was a similar like, all right, well, that seems to work, but it wasn't necessarily based on like a track record of high quality the way that somebody today would be like, oh, I definitely want to work with Greta Gerwig as a director because she's an esteemed director. It was just, oh, yeah, that person made a thing that we like. So I think they'll get us.
I saw a good quote. You just reminded me and I forgot about it. I saw a good quote that Richard Lester had that I want to read. There was like a social aspect that Richard Lester understood as well. So what he had said about the film was the general aim of the film was to present what was apparently becoming a social phenomenon in this country. Anarchy is too strong a word, but the quality of confidence that the boys exuded, confidence that they could dress as they liked, speak as they liked, talk to the queen as they liked, talk to people on the train who fought the war for them as they liked. Everything was still based on privilege. Privileged by schooling, privileged by birth, privileged by accent, privileged by speech. The Beatles were the first people to attack this. They said, if you want something, do it. You can do it. forget all this talk about talent or ability or money or speech, just do it. That was the Richard Lester quote about making this film and I guess why it was special.
Yeah, I mean, it cannot be stressed enough how revolutionary it was that they used their native accents. Like, that was a big freaking deal. They were Northerners, they were Scousers, they were working class, and they didn't hide that. They didn't even attempt to sing. Like, a lot of British groups would attempt to sing in American accents because they knew when there was a big, you know, consumer base in the States for rock music. They didn't even do that. And they were like, no, we're going to talk the way we talk. Like, it was pretty, pretty wild.
I had read online that one of the producers wanted to dub their voices
to
transatlantic
crazy?
Accents. Yes, that's crazy. I can't imagine it. All right. So is there anything else that like a layperson like me who maybe I know more than other people do, like I know their music pretty well, but is there anything else a layperson should know about this movie that would help them to appreciate it even more?
It's considered the Citizen Kane of jukebox movies. And I honestly, it's like not just jukebox movies. It's just a good movie. It's like surreal. It's like handheld, you know, camera, cinema verite, like you mentioned. It's so much better than it had any right to be, like I said.
It's music videos before music videos, especially what Jason was talking about with like the helicopter shots.
The Beatles invented music videos. And not with this movie, but they invented music videos. MTV, because they were so busy, they were so heavily booked. Like, they would, like, film themselves performing something and then, like, send it to Ed Sullivan or whatever show. And, like, that was the proto music video.
Another fact that I read about was that, okay, there were some things that I don't know. Like, there was an in-joke that they were like, this is an in-joke. And I was like, I don't get it. I don't know what that joke is. So there's some stuff that I was like, I don't know about that. But I was just reading that the grandpa, the reason that they keep calling him, doesn't he look clean or isn't he clean, is because apparently he was on like a British sitcom where they kept calling him a dirty old man. So that was kind of like an in joke. And that actor was Wilford Brimley.
It was the show that became, when they brought it to America, did an American version. The American version was Sanford and Son.
No.
And so he was the red fox of Steptoe and Son, who ran the junkyard and was a dirty old man.
Yeah.
And so that's why they kept calling him clean. And that's why that was funny. And we would have gotten that in 1964.
But it's amazing that that's still, like, even if you don't know that, just as a running joke, it's still funny.
It's still funny.
Like, for reasons where you're just like, that's weird that everybody's catching on to that. Like, you can't, it's not a setup punchline kind of thing. It's just everybody's like, it's very clean.
Also, he is creepy looking. He looks normal at first, and then he smiles, and his teeth look like little knives. And you're like, ooh, I am unsettled by this.
He's got these little sharp, like, lowercase teeth. I have to make sure that we all know he was only 52 when this was made. He's like in this movie about old enough to be Paul's dad, let alone Paul's grandfather, because Paul would have been 22. So he's 30 years older. And just out there, what does Ringo say? Being middle-aged and old takes up most of your time, doesn't it?
Yeah, great line. There are a lot of really funny gags. I will say, I know that they shot it. I don't know. I read that they shot it like chronologically. And you can tell in the earlier scenes that the Beatles don't really know what they're doing as much acting-wise.
They're a little rough.
And that there's one line that was cracking me up this time that Ringo says. I don't even remember what it is, but he says it really quickly. And then he does like a wooden laugh. And I was like, oh, I'm so uncomfortable. It's like you're watching them learn to act on the spot and they get better as the movie goes on. So by Ringo's like sad parading end, you're like, look, you learned how to act. Look at you go.
I know exactly what line you're talking about. It's when John says, he can talk, can he? Well, of course he can talk. And Ringo says, well, if he's your grandfather, who knows?
But that was better than his delivery.
But I think for me, I like it's wooden and weird, but I think it works because then everybody just kind of stares at him and that they're not laughing with him. They're like, what is wrong with you? What are you even doing right now? Like, that's such a good moment. But when he is out parading the streets, he was super hungover.
Really?
Ringo was like they'd gone out partying the night before. So like, yeah, it's a great showcase. And I think probably directly led to him being the focus of Help and then having roles in like Candy and Caveman and like an acting career later on. But that day he's just like, so what, I just like kind of wander around by this river or whatever? Yeah, fine. yeah, just roll camera on my head.
But it worked because he's supposed to be kind of bummed out. It works great. And he looks so chic in that part. When he goes into that store and gets that amazing trench coat and that great hat, it's like a style moment. I loved everything about it. I thought he looked stylish and a little blue. And now I know he was hungover.
Movie magic.
Also, shout out to Ringo. And side note, I love the way he plays the drums. He's got like the Ringo head bob that he does. Mm-hmm. It's very smooth. Like, I really liked watching him play.
The swishy right hand on the hi-hat. It's not just a hard up and down. I know that this isn't a visual medium for the listeners at home, but just look up footage of Ringo and you'll see what I mean, that the hi-hat is always very swishy back and forth.
Ringo is underappreciated. Well, no, professional drummers know how good he is. But there's like, for a while, it felt like it was a trend or it was cool to be like, oh, Ringo sucks. But no, Ringo was like a human metronome. He could keep time perfectly, so perfectly that they could like even stitch different takes together and it would still like be totally in time. Even Paul McCartney has said, yeah, he like working with Ringo, he's like a human metronome. And he has a distinctive style that as soon as you hear him play, oh, yeah, that's Ringo Starr.
Well, and don't people look down on him just because he wasn't the songwriter that like the McCartney and Lennon were and Harrison too? Like, is that it?
Next to Lennon and McCartney, we all suffer by comparison.
Right?
Some people look down on him because he's not a flashy drummer the way that like Keith Moon or John Bonham are. Like, he's not in this like very technical sense, but as a musician, as somebody that is like playing these songs, he is always doing exactly what the song needs. Whether it's simple or complex. And he was, like, I think by the general public, more beloved. That scene where they're all getting the fan mail and Ringo's like, oh, none for me. And then they bring in like a bigger stack that's just for him. That's absolutely true. Like, he got more fan mail than anybody else.
Americans love an underdog.
Well, yeah. And then it's funny because they set him up that way too. So I wonder if like, our ideas about Ringo in this situation are also from the movies, because in Help, he's set apart from everybody. And then in Hard Day's Night, he's kind of set apart from everybody. So I wonder if it's like a self-creating narrative, too.
He was also the last one to join the band. He had only, I mean, when did he, they kicked out Pete Best? I
was like 62.
62. Yeah. So he's still like only been in the band about a year and a half at this point.
So like, would it help for people at home too? So you're, again, people at home, I cannot stress to you, these people are experts. You don't even know. So I'm going to ask, would it help to like explain the backstory of the Beatles a little bit? We'll do like a quick backstory and then like maybe like what's going on in this moment in time and why it's special.
Their story has been so mythologized. Like, people pin the start of the Beatles on when John and Paul met, but really Paul met George first on the bus to school. They were like school friends. They both like had guitars. They're like, hey, do you play guitar? Yeah, me too. Let's hang out. But then, like, the creation myth of the Beatles is this church fate in, what is it, June or July of 1957, which is when John met Paul. And it was like, you want to join my band? Sure, okay. And then they were off to the races from there. I'm trying to be as brief as I can.
You're doing great. No, this is great. Jason, what happened next?
John meets Paul at the Wolton Fate. They're like, let's start a band. John's got this band. And then they invite George because they're like, hey, my buddy's like, he's a kid, but he's like a good, because George would have been like 14.
Very young.
Like, these are, we have to stress, they are like children when they're doing all this. They're not in their early 20s. They're like mid to late teens. Start a band, rotating bunch of drummers. They also had a bass player named Stu, John's other best friend. They go to Hamburg. They like really hone their craft. Stu stays in Hamburg. The rest go back. They're like really starting to like get their stuff. Stu dies of a brain hemorrhage at age 20. Oh, it's very sad.
That's a huge part of the Beatles mythology. Like, John, that was his best friend. And like, John lost his voice for days afterwards after he found out. It was like,
there are these beautiful black and white photos of them like visiting with Stu's girlfriend. And John, you can just see he's like a ghost of a man. I mean, it's amazing that we have all this documentation of, like, it's mythologized, but there's also, like, and you can see the photos.
Yeah.
Or you can hear, like, there are audio recordings of the day John met Paul. Like, you can hear John's band, the Quarrymen.
He was playing, Come Go With Me by the Dell Vikings.
And changing up his own the lyrics. Words, yeah, to be, like, blues lyrics about come down, down, down to the penitentiary.
Yeah, because that was another thing. I mean, nowadays it's standard for when you a song is released, you get the lyrics to it too. I mean, like when you bought CDs back in the day, there would be a booklet and all the lyrics would be in there. That was not par for the course back then. You would have to like buy the record and just listen to it over and over and over again and write the lyrics as you heard them. That was how you learned the words to songs. So if I mean, John clearly hadn't done that enough with Come Go With Me because he didn't know all the words.
Or he wanted to be silly. I don't know. I like changing words.
They understood the importance of getting the words right because they were the first to put the words on the back of a record when they put out Sgt. Pepper.
Very first one.
Whoa.
Yeah.
So again, my Beatles experts, what makes the Beatles music special? And I do also want to shout out one thing that there is appropriation, especially in the early Beatles music. So there is cultural appropriation. They do perform songs that were made famous by Black performers. I just want to like shout that out. But like, what makes the Beatles so special and so different?
I think because you're absolutely right that they were singing these songs that were largely made famous by blackguards, whether or not the Beatles themselves had heard those versions first, because a lot of other white artists in America were also capitalizing on this.
Elvis is a great example of someone who has capitalized,
They've
yeah.
got versions of like Ray Charles' I Got a Woman that when they do it, it definitely sounds more like, oh, they weren't listening to the Ray Charles version. They were probably listening to like Elvis covering it. But that everything they did, especially early on, came from excitement about and love of the music, that it wasn't coming from this, hey, let's capitalize on this trend. Hey, let's take this music by underprivileged people and like give it to privileged people. I mean, you see that scene in the Baz Luhrmann Elvis, love or hate the movie, but you see these sequences of like Elvis hanging out on Beale Street and hanging out in these clubs because it was of a genuine love of the music that transcended race more so than like Paul Anka sings the hits of Paul Anka sings Little Richard or Pat Boone sings Little Richard. That it was just such excitement because growing up in like post-war London, all you have is like light orchestras on the BBC, and suddenly you just hear this electric music that John heard Elvis and was like, what? All right, this is my whole identity. And then he heard Little Richard and he was like, I already made my whole identity Elvis, but this is even cooler. Like, what do I do? Like, I'm having an identity crisis based on a song I just heard. And they wanted to just create that excitement for other people. There's this great quote in the Mary McCartney documentary, If These Walls Could Sing, about Abbey Road. It's one of the Gallaghers of Oasis talking about the same time period. And he said there was no nostalgia. They weren't saying, hey, let's make music like our youth. Let's go back to the stuff that we used to like. It was like, no, our childhoods were terrible and bombed out. So we can only look forward. We can only make things that we think are new and exciting to us currently, right now. And that perfect storm of like no history to fall back on and new and unexplored territory with mixed with four of the best friends the world has ever seen. That's the magic. And that's what this movie demonstrates is like these guys were friends. The Stones, the Who, great musicians. You see your Mick and Keith or something like that, but you don't see you. I can't think of another band that truly, short of like a more packaged, the Spice Girls or One Direction, that had this level of like, these guys love each other so dearly.
And that was like real? Because
A
they,
hundred
they
percent.
break up and they never get back
Well,
together.
but here's the thing. After they broke up, and I think especially after John was murdered, everyone picked a side, weirdly. Like you're pro John, anti Paul, or you're pro Paul, anti John. And honestly, like a lot, I remember once I was listening to a podcast about like why the Beatles broke up. And I could tell listening to it that all the sources they had used for their reporting were they're anti-John. It was like all everything was
Oh.
slanted and it was obvious. I never understood that impulse, like to pit them against each other, because that's not the way it was. They were four friends and everything, you know. I mean, no, they fought, yeah. They had fights and tiffs and they disagreed about stuff, but at the end of the day, yeah, they loved making music together.
It was very real, especially because the work they had to do to get to that level And the work they had to do at that level was something that could really only be understood by, you know, the other three for any one of them. And then like their manager and producer, but they had like, they had a very small crew. So really the four of them playing these Hamburg clubs for like long, long hours, like, you know, three sets a night of 2 hour sets, then moving into the Cavern Club and then suddenly blowing up and touring the world. And they could only, I think Ringo said when they first like came to America and they rented out an entire floor at the Plaza, and it was still just the four of them like huddled up in a bathroom together because they're like, I don't know what to do by myself. I haven't like been by myself in a couple years now. Like it was a little bit codependent, but still with love. They said Elvis didn't have that. Elvis was just Elvis. There were not three other Elvises that he could hang out with that understood what it was like. But for them, one, that they all like played sort of different parts in this band. They all understood their roles to the, you know, the whole being greater than the sum of the parts. And having been there, even with Ringo sort of being the new guy, he'd been there long enough to be like, yeah, this is crazy. I'm so glad I've got you guys here. It was a very real, deeply felt love. So the breakup was even more devastating because it was like a divorce. It like the world's parents got divorced.
I will say, I think something that is special about the Beatles, they were such a phenomenon and they could have kept making the same kind of music forever. But to me, they were a band that was constantly growing and like trying to find new creative paths consistently. And that's why their music remained so good, because they didn't want to just stick in one lane. They were really, they were curious and they were willing to try new things and willing to be really creative and make really different sounds than what had been played in pop music before.
Oh yeah. I mean, to bring it back to the movie, that opening chord of A Hard Day's Night, oof, which is so famous, that's on a, in the movie, George plays a 12-string guitar. It was only the second one ever produced.
Whoa.
And it, I mean, that was a new sound. All the strings, like a regular guitar has six strings, and then the other six strings on this 12-string are like doubled up. And it has a very distinct sound to it. And like, of course, the guy from the Birds, Roger McGinn, heard that and was like, oh my God. And that was basically the Birds' entire sound was built around the electric 12-string guitar.
Also, I need to shout this out. Justice for George as well. We already did like justice for Ringo, justice for George. He has a big guitar solo in this movie and they're focused on everybody else but him. And then finally they go to his hands for like 3 seconds. And I'm like, why aren't you showing us George playing the guitar? He literally has a guitar solo. Also, was there no one there to fix his eyebrows? He has a unibrow and it is so distracting because we don't see that in movies now. And I just was like, was there no makeup person there on set to help him?
Knowing George and his personality, if they had come at him with tweezers, he would have been like, back off.
Or he would have said something deeply cutting.
But he was also like getting over the flu. This was just after their appearances on the Ed Sullivan Show when they did this. And he got really, really sick, which is where the whole thing of the quiet beetle comes from. He was sick. So he like, there were certain photo ops where he wasn't there because he was back at the hotel recovering. And then that was, oh, he's the quiet beetle. It's like, no, he really wasn't. He was not. He was the cursing beetle. He was the one who would stand up when things were like bad, like the conditions, because they had to do all kinds of crazy things to get into and out of venues because the fans were so nuts. They would like have to be transported in like fish trucks that smelled and all this. I mean, George was the one who would be like, listen, motherfuckers, no.
Did the thing that they do in the movie, was that based on a real thing where they like secretly went through one car to get to another car to get out of there? Did that ever happen in real life?
I would not be surprised. I know Alan Owen, the screenwriter, followed them around to see like, how do they talk? How do they interact? Where does this language come from? But also, what are these conditions that they're having to do all this in? And I think, you know, I think the going through one car to get to a second probably happened, or at least through one car to maybe get to like a more armored truck or something like that. They would definitely have to do weird things like that.
Also, in this movie, they did keep the shot with the fan falling down. And you're like, oh, man, she tanked it. She fell down really hard.
Well, what, in the beginning?
We're still going.
In the beginning,
yeah.
Oh, no, because that's George and Ringo that fall.
No, but there's a woman.
There's a
woman. There's a fan.
I'm always so distracted by watching, like, half the Beatles go down, too. because they said like, all right, you run, they'll chase you. But at that point, you can't really expect that these like teen girls are just going to stop when the director yells cut. So when they fall, they're like, oh no, oh no. And they get back up and they're kind of laughing in a way of like, that was really close. I hope we don't die.
There is a shot where there's a girl that bites it. It's from the side and she bites it real hard. And you're like, oh, I hope she's not trampled and I hope she's okay. We'll never know.
That must have been tough in the movie, just dealing with like, yeah, forward momentum and don't crush your fellow fans or the other Beatles.
But they got real reactions. That's what's so incredible. We have all these like very intense, real reactions of people. Like the camera was right in their face and these extras, these girls, these teen girls are like really serving. They are serving their feelings.
Even in the quieter moments, like when they're doing I Should Have Known Better on the train and they've got like a couple fans and they've got Patty Boyd, future Mrs. George Harrison, in the cage with them. That and this is where they met. But she's like, her job isn't to chase anybody or to scream. It's just to like hang out and watch. And you can see her struggling so hard to keep it together. She's just like just stifling a scream, holding back tears. It's a powerful thing. And I will say, I've seen this movie easily 50 times and, you know, all sorts of other footage of Beatlemania. I'm like, well, I've seen Paul McCartney live. Like, you know, we all scream when it comes out, but like then we enjoy the show, right? Like I didn't fully get it until about 10 years ago. I was waiting outside Capitol. He was doing a live stream inside when he put out that like jazz record. And then all the limos start coming out and his limo pulls out and pauses for a second and he rolls down the window and it's Paul. And he's like right in front of me and he starts like waving and he kind of sticks his hand out. And we all like rush the limo and I brush his hand. And immediately after that, I let out an involuntary scream. And then I went, oh, I get it. I get it. Like,
yeah,
they have no control over this. This is just like, oh, I touched a beetle. Oh, my God. Oh. Like it happens from this primal place that I didn't understand just watching the footage.
Plus, it is something about that age because as a young person, boy bands were very big. And I was lucky enough to see NSYNC in concert when I was 12. And it is like a group thing. Like you're so excited to see them. You've been listening to their songs your whole freaking life and you're finally in their presence. And then it just, it's like being that age too. It's like a whole part of it. And I can't quite explain it, but I screamed my head off at that concert and I was deaf when I left for like 20 minutes and that had never happened before. And so I think it's like, it feeds on itself. It's like the people around you are doing it. You're doing it. You're at that age where like you have no other outlet for this.
The teenager was a new thing in the early 60s. They weren't a separate consumer group.
But this happened before too. This happened with Frank Sinatra and Bing Crosby with the crooners. So like this was not a new thing. We just didn't have like proper footage of it.
Oh, it happened like, with Elvis too. And even Paul Anka. Paul Anka was the big thing like a year before the Beatles hit, I think. Yeah, there's a really good short documentary called Lonely Boy about Paul Anka. And he inspired all these screaming hordes of girls. And it's funny watching it now because I think it's his manager says like, no one will ever be this big again. And it's like, dude, it's 1963. Hold your horses.
Also, since we're talking about like extras and things like that, there were boys in that crowd too. And I want to give a shout out to Phil Collins, who was apparently an extra in this
film. Phil Collins.
I don't know where he was, but that's what I read, that he was an extra. And I went, wow.
I'm always scouring the crowd trying to find like the eyebrows. But no, I've never been able to spot him, but every time I watch it with somebody, that's one of my like go-to, like, you know, one of those fellas is Phil Collins.
One of the things I think is really interesting about this movie, now we're used to a jukebox musical where like the song that someone is singing will have to do with what's going on in the scene. But in this movie, the songs that they're singing, like they're either performing songs, like, hey, we're a band and we're pretending we're live performing this, or they're performing, like there's a soundtrack playing and they're doing like action to it. And often the song that's playing has nothing to do with the plot or the action going on the screen. It's like really just from the album and they're kind of like playing the album for you to a movie. Like it doesn't fit in the same way we're used to.
A handful of the songs in the movie are not on the Hard Day's Night soundtrack. Like She Loves You that they perform at the end. That was one of their, calling it older is a misnomer, but yeah, it wasn't. And then they also play This Boy, which was a non-album single.
And when they're in the dance club, there's like All My Loving and Don't Bother Me and stuff. That was, I think, a little bit also just to like throw the fans a bone to be like, here's some of the songs you already know, because this is a new movie with new music and it's the Beatles. And ultimately, everybody I've heard in the theater, in the movie theater where the Beatles weren't even there, were still screaming throughout the entire movie. So it almost doesn't matter what the songs were. But yeah, no, they weren't writing like, okay, so then we're going to run in a field. So let's write a song called Running Around in a Field.
They'd be like, we're singing Can't Buy Me Love, but we're running down a fire escape. And you're like, okay, that's fine. Yeah. It doesn't need to make sense. But some of the songs, people at home that are in this film, I think the most famous songs are obviously Hard Day's Night, which I do love that the movie starts with that. And it has that discordant chord to like open everything. Ooh, I love it. So we have Hard Day's Night. We have She Loves You. We have All My Lovin', Can't Buy Me Love. And I Love Her. What a good song. And If I Fell. I feel like those are maybe the most famous. But you know, every song they sing, you're like, oh, I know this song. And they're all hits. They're all like, not a bad song in the bunch.
I'm a bad person to ask about like whether or not a song is considered famous. Because in my mind, there's a few that I'm like, okay, yeah, a lot of people probably don't know like this one song. But when it comes to like every song that's in A Hard Day's Night, I'm like, I don't. I think there's like A tier is like Can't Buy Me Love and A Hard Day's Night, and then everything else I'm like A minus tier, like they're all equally well known, they're all hits to me. Like for me, Tell Me Why, when they like when they start the big performance scene in the television studio at the very end, to get to the dump, for me that's like, that song is 2.5 minutes of electric pop perfection. The energy is just so high that in my mind I'm like, yeah, that's up there with A Hard Day's Night and Can't Buy Me Love and Help and any other like major Beatles movie song.
Although it is interesting to me how the lyrics are a little more sentimental earlier in their career versus later. Like it's definitely much sweeter earlier on and almost a little cheesy too, but I love it.
Pop music was all love songs. It was like boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl back, or girl wants boy, boy is with another girl. You know, all the permutations of relationship.
From me to you, love me, do, thank you, girl. A lot of like me and you stuff. I think the first single that they had that wasn't a love song was Paperback Writer, and that was like 2 years after this. But yeah, pretty much every song in this movie. A Hard Day's Night is like, it's not in the title, but it's still about like, at the end of the day, I want to come home to you, girl.
Yeah. When I get home to you, I find the things that you do will make me feel all right.
All right. Not all great, right. Just all right.
Like pop songs, oh yeah, there were a lot of love and relationship themes, but also like another way that the Beatles were kind of revolutionary is the way that they wrote their music. Like a lot of times lyricists would kind of twist their lines to make them rhyme, like the moon, June, cheesy stuff, but the lyrics in Beatles songs are really clever. But also I have this book that I have on my shelf right now. It's like a sociological view of the Beatles, and apparently like in some of their songs they call the girl friend. Like that was revolutionary, like the idea that we could be friends and lovers, we could be equals in this partnership. And like, you know, the girls who were listening to these records were like, wow, that's like head exploding. The other thing is that even though they were singing all these love songs, the Beatles were viewed as non-threatening because they were so what counted as effeminate back then. They had the long hair, which was very unusual. I remember once I found a photo when they were coming to the US for the first time, someone took a photo of the four of them and gave them all crew cuts because their hair was too long. It was effeminate and girly. And
but their hair is amazing. I was loving their hair. It's the style of their hair, one, holds up today. Two, those cuts are fresh. I loved them. The texture is gorgeous. I think they did a great job. No notes. They should have kept them forever and no one should have ever been mad about it. Like that doesn't happen. Things remain stylish throughout this time. The 60s did have a lot of style that has maintained. Like I was looking at,
totally.
There's the scene with like that secretary and she has bangs and long hair and like a cool like outfit.
Oh,
and
that you could
wear all of that today. Everything she was wearing, I could wear that today and be just as stylish, you
know? Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Also that scene is possibly my favorite scene in the movie.
Ad exec, you can be replaced, chicken baby.
I love that part. But I didn't love that George lost that woman her job. Not cool, George. Not cool.
Susan?
He lost Susan her job. Yeah, the resident teenager.
She's your idol.
He needed that money.
We like to turn the sound down on her and say rude things.
I will put forth that George might be the funniest person in this movie. Like, both the lines that he gets, as well as his, like, his timing when they find that old guy in the closet, and yeah, like Ringo or somebody like, hey, have you left a man in the cupboard? And George goes, he walks, he opens the cupboard, sees the guy, closes it, walks all the way back, sits down, and goes, he's right, you know. Like, it's so well timed. So to see him in that like ad exec space where he's being mistaken for like a proto influencer, I guess. It's like, we want you to give your opinion of some fashion. And he goes, oh, yes, I'd be quite prepared for that eventuality.
Not your actual opinion.
He's so snarky. Like, and he's freshly 21. He's a baby. They're filming this in March. Yeah, his birthday was like a month ago. Yeah, Ringo's probably doing the best acting, and John is probably the most electric to just watch, even when he's doing nothing. And Paul is like the cute, safe one.
Paul's barely there.
But he's like trying. Anytime Paul has lines, you can tell he's like, it's a chance to do acting.
He's trying really hard. He's a ham.
But he's adorable.
That's why his scene was cut, because he's a ham.
That's because I was like, why is Paul barely in this? That's what's so funny. His lines about the grandfather were all great. Just him constantly, that partnership. Because Paul ends up looking like the clean one. And then the dirty grandpa, who they're calling clean, you know, is crazy. So they're like a great odd couple. But yeah, you watch it and you're like, oh, but Paul was, everybody loved Paul. So why did Paul not have a bigger part? And it's because he was a ham. They cut his scene.
The plan was for each of them to have their little solo excursion. So obviously Ringo's is, you know, when he goes parading, George in the ad exec's office, and John with the woman in the hallway. It's like, oh, you look just like him. Paul's was cut. Paul had a whole conversation with a Shakespearean actress, in a rehearsal space. Like, the script is online. You can read it and see what the scene was. But I mean, who knows if we'll ever see the footage while Paul's alive.
Wow. Cause he's like, please don't show that. Please.
Well, I don't know. I'm sure he thought he was doing all right. I mean, he was the one who was dating an actress at the time. So it was like, I can act.
Dating an actress does not an actor make. Let me just say that.
No. Yeah. Paul doesn't get, he doesn't get that bit. But I think because he's paired with grandfather, you still feel his presence, even with the grandfather as like, well, that's Paul's grandfather. That's not random old man. Like, you get the connectivity to him. I think you're right that, like, they were, to the earlier point, they were all very safe. I know on Ed Sullivan, it was like a really shrewd move that they opened with All My Loving, which is a very Paul, like, Paul-centric thing. So, like, mm-hmm. The Beatles and all these parents are like, yeah, I've been hearing about this. And you see this, like, nice love song with, like, Paul front and center, like, working the camera, being a little bit of a ham. And then they immediately follow that with their version of Till There Was You from The Music Man, which is like, oh, and here's one for the parents, like, still very safe. We all know this song. Like, aren't they just lovely boys? Paul was like the manifestation of they're just lovely boys. And John was like the firecracker. And George was like, he doesn't say much, but when he does, watch out. And then Ringo.
Happy to be there.
We can talk about some of our favorite moments in the film. Favorite quotes that you have? I mean, you had talked about how, like, you think George is the funniest. I thought they gave John some very, very funny lines and some very funny moments. And right in the beginning, when he's snorting Coke, but it's not cocaine, it's Coca-Cola. And you're like, oh, boy.
Pepsi. It's Pepsi.
He's snorting Pepsi. But I was just like, oh, I see the joke here. I see what we're doing. And that kind of, like, sets us up for the rest of the shenanigans to follow.
You're a swine.
What are some of you? I mean, I already mentioned Ringo just walking around in that jacket. I love forever. And on a musical note, I loved the jazzy Hard Day's Night they were playing at that point. And I was like, I want to find a copy of this. I enjoy it.
I have definitely, like, say, like, dropped something and gone like, oh, torpedoed again, eh?
Oh, did you call anything grotty?
A word invented by Alan Owen in this movie. Nobody had used grotty before.
Not even the Beatles.
Yeah, not even the Beatles.
Oh, that's so fetch.
I will definitely throw in, like, I something something regularly, twice a week. Like when with the older man in the train, because I ride this train regularly, twice a week, and I will find myself being like, oh, yeah, I go to that bar all the time. Twice a week. That old man was 39.
Oh my God. They all look so old. The grandpa looks like 70s. That old guy looks mid-50s. Wow, people looked way older back then.
Yeah.
Also, he was so obnoxious and privileged, and I was mad on their behalf.
I fought the war for your sword.
Bet you're sorry you won.
Give us our bowl back!
Side note about that actor, though. The actor on the train. His name. Yeah. That actor's name is Richard Vernon. And if you're thinking to yourself, why does that name sound familiar? That's the name of the teacher from The Breakfast Club. That was intentional.
Whoa, Sarah. Wow, our brains just exploded. And we have a Breakfast Club podcast for you folks at home, should you want to listen to it. But we don't say that because I didn't know it till right now.
But yeah, no, the class difference is definitely... One thing I noticed too this go around when I saw it, I hadn't thought about it before. I'm a huge history nerd. The bit where they're running around being chased by the cops, but in a fun way... There's that guy trying to break into the cars in the street. Behind him, it looks like there are like some partially demolished buildings. Like there's like crumbling brick walls and whatever. Those are probably bombed out buildings from World War II that still hadn't been cleared away.
Whoa.
I noticed that on this watch. Like I had always been like, yeah, he's in front of like a thing. But I it was only on this watch the other night when I went, oh, I bet that's like, that's from the Blitz. Like that's... And we're like 20 years later.
And it seems weird because, I mean, yeah, like the United States bounced back pretty quickly from World War II. I mean, we were all like, you know, middle class, build the middle class. Everyone has a house and a car and all that. But England did not bounce back very quickly from the war. I mean, none of the Beatles were old enough to remember probably any of the war, any of the bombings. You know, they were all up in Liverpool, which was a major target by the Luftwaffe because... Liverpool was a major port city and there was a Navy shipyard. They were building ships and all that. So it was a strategic target. But like when they were growing up, they would play in what they called the bombies. They were bombed out buildings, just piles of rubble. And those were their playgrounds where they would play. And like all this stuff was still sitting there. Yeah. Even into the 60s. And like there was still food rationing going on well into the 50s, I think. It stopped late enough that, yeah, all four of them probably remembered the day that food rationing ended, finally able to get enough sugar for their tea, you know, all that stuff. But I mean, then, and I think that is part of why they were so big is because, like, the post-war doldrums were just dragging on so long. And then here you have this fresh-faced group singing really, like, you know, sincere, fun, exciting pop music. And they were just a riot to watch and listen to. And
that probably leads into some of their energy about all this is like, we've sort of seen the world around us destroyed, whether or not they watched it be destroyed, but they've at least lived in this space of like, any of this can probably get blown up at any point and things are really hard. So we've got something good. And let's like, let's really just run with this because between seeing the destruction and as you mentioned, all the reporters being like, so how long do you think this can really go on? Like, yeah, they're like, well, let's not waste any time. Let's not ever just get comfortable with one thing. Let's keep going. Let's make this like something because we may not have this chance again.
Especially like Ringo. Ringo is the worst off of the four. Like he grew up dirt poor. His dad left the family. His mom was a single working mom. Like, and he also had a host of health issues where he would spend more time in the hospital than in school. Like he had a rough life.
He was like illiterate till he was like 10.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah.
And yet he wrote Octopus's Garden.
And he's just also a delight. I remember a couple years ago when Get Back came out and there's that one shot where Ringo like looks up, he finds the camera and he just gives a big sunny smile. And it like became a meme online. Like everyone's like, look at this pure ball of sunshine.
He is.
He came out of incredible hardship.
Well, and I think they all also have a sense of humor about what's happening. They don't take themselves as seriously as they could. And so I think my favorite scene in this movie is the press scene. I think it's a great scene because it's so meta. It's so like everything that you wish you could actually respond to the press, I bet, is what they were thinking in their head. So it's like the press asking inane questions over and over. Paul has to keep saying the same thing of like, no, we're just friends. And they ask him about his dad and he's like, we're just friends. Like,
well, a lot of those were real questions and real yes. answers that they gave.
Well, my favorite was, has success changed your life? And then I forget who said it, but they're like, yes.
George.
It was George. He goes, yes. And that's it.
Dead silence.
I love that. It's the best. And then the part with Ringo, you will all know the quote. I do not.
Are you a mod or a rocker?
No, I'm a mocker.
I'm a mocker. Right?
What do you call that hairstyle you're wearing?
Arthur. And there was actually a nightclub in New York City that opened called Arthur. How did you find America? Turn left at Greenland.
All of it. I don't know. I think it's a really fun scene. I think it pokes enough fun at real life to be really worth it. And then those pictures of George that they take are really fun to look at and watch. Like, it's a cool piece of film that they just put in that scene. So I don't know. I love that scene. And then, I will say another gross thing in that scene is one of the reporters asks, how do you like your girlfriends to dress? I didn't even hear the answer because I just wrote, yikes.
Oh, no, Ringo just laughs. He's like, kind of laughs nervously of like,
Because that's a terrible, why have you asked that? What is wrong with you?
They would get questions like that all the time.
But it was a time where that was a thing. Like, girlfriends would be like, well, I have to dress the way my boyfriend wants me. Cynthia Lennon was like, well, John likes Brigitte Bardot, so I guess I will dress like that because that's how he likes his women to look. This is not a defense of that, but like it's shocking today, but at the time was very much like, yes, because of the patriarchy, this is a reasonable question to ask people.
We have the Hey Little Girl song that's like, you know, wives have to be lovers too, you know, like, hey, little girl, like that whole nonsense song telling you got to be gorgeous for your man because that's your only goddamn job, that, you know, it's that kind of fucked up mindset. You know, you're not a human, you're a prop.
On the other side, there is the woman that asks John, have you any hobbies? And he writes something down on a piece of paper and hands it to her, and her eyes go big, and what he wrote was tits.
That's silly. John,
I don't know if her reaction was genuine or if she was just, her job was to just like look surprised, like, no matter what she
shocking.
Wrote.
Well, so I have this movie, I have a Criterion Collection DVD that comes with like a big thick booklet with all these essays and stuff. And that whole sequence was just like impromptu. They, like, Dick Lester went around and is like, all right, all these people who are standing around here, all the reporters who came to set hoping for a quote or whatever, just go up in this room in a couple hours, we're going to shoot a press conference. And so they all went in there. And to a degree, it was like he would feed lines to them, like, hey, reporter, ask George this. And I think a lot of that was just like on the fly improv, which is the way that Dick Lester likes to work. Like, as a director, he's very improvisational. And yeah, he would throw them lines from off camera and just have them repeat it. If they didn't quite say it right, he would give them a different line reading and they would mimic him. They trusted him again. Because he had worked with Spike Milligan and Peter Sellers and the Goons, all that. So,
well, and that's probably how they made this so quick too, you know?
Oh yeah. And you definitely, if you watch other press conferences from the era, like the Beatles were that quick and funny in real life. It's not like the movie doesn't beg the question, what if the Beatles were funny? Like they were. If you watch their press conference when they come to America and they're asking them questions like, you know, when are you going to get your hair cut? And I think George says, like, I got mine yesterday. And then they're like, what do you think about the claims that you're just a bunch of British Elvis Presleys? And Ringo goes, it's not true. It's not true.
Doing a little Elvis dance.
One of my favorite quotes in this movie was, you can be replaced, cheeky baby. Great line. I want to start saying that to everybody everywhere.
Can we talk about that scene? Because I legit think that that's like the sharpest critique of pop culture and commercialism and consumerism of like the entire 20th century filmmaking, maybe? Is that a big claim? First of all, that actor, I'm going to blank on his name, but the actor who plays the ad exec had a really good run. Like, this is 1964. He appeared in the pilot episode of The Twilight Zone as like the pilot who time travels. And he's also in Spartacus. So he was having a pretty good run as an actor there, but also just like the fact that, and then his assistant Adrian immediately recognizes, hey, that's George Harrison. And he's like, don't breathe on me, Adrian. I love all that. But just like the idea of what's popular being manufactured, you know, with Susan Canby.
Our resident teenager.
She's your idol. Oh, you mean the posh bird that gets everything wrong? The calendar that he turns to, like, is he a clue to the new direction? Wait, is it? Oh, no, we're not due for another 3 weeks. He's just a troublemaker. The idea that everything is like, you can anticipate when things become popular and what becomes popular, and you can dictate what people wear and what people listen to. I mean, I'm sure people, like the money people on Wall Street, would love if that was the case, but it's not. You know, who knows? I mean, no one could have predicted that the Beatles would become what they did. But I think the whole thing is just such a sharp rebuke and a satire of like how all that works, how corporations capitalize on what the kids are into these days. And George is just sitting there like, I don't care.
I do feel like corporations sometimes force things to be popular, because I felt like in the past, like when we were teenagers, they would just play songs on the radio that I'd be like, I don't even like this song. But then you'd hear it 1,000 times and then you're like, okay, I know it now. So I guess it's part of my, like, this is our history now. Like,
yeah.
So I think they did used to like jam it down our throats a little bit more, and they would make things popular just by sheer force of like, we're going to play this song 1,000 times till you like it or at least recognize it enough to sing along.
I mean, there was, that is true. Like, I can think of an example that was a little more on the payola side. Of the song, the 80s hit Break My Stride by Matthew Wilder. Apparently, they actually like went to some radio station that was known for breaking people. And basically, they just told America, like, this song's a hit. This one's topping the charts. Like, this one's getting played everywhere. And people were like, oh, wow, really? Well, it must be pretty good then. And it was just all a lie until it was true.
You know what? I enjoy that song.
It's a great song.
Ain't nothing gonna break my stride. That's the one, right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. It's a catchy tune.
Oh, the whole monologue that the grandfather gives Ringo, like in the police station, that's just so like anti-cop and from a, in 1964, specifically like very Irish bend of like I'm a member of the Republic. Like, it's the fact that this like jukebox Beatles musical has both like a critique of pop culture and the state of the police, even though the joke is like, oh, they'll bring out the rubber hoses, and then it cuts to the cops that are like, would you like a cup of tea?
Yeah.
And they're like, they really just brought them in for their own protection.
They're white dudes. They're not gonna, you know, be harmed. And
but also that it touches on the partition of Ireland, the Irish Free State, and all that.
He starts singing "A Nation" once again.
Well, and then the cop calls him Lloyd George too, which is also a deep cut. If you're British, I mean, yeah. What is that doing in a silly jukebox movie for teenagers?
I mean, it helps illustrate more about who Grandfather is besides being just like a conniving, weird old dude.
He is chaos incarnate. That's what I felt the whole time. He knows how to manipulate everyone to put them at the most disadvantage.
He's a king mixer.
That actor was not up for improvising. Like, he was very classically trained. He learned his lines. And so if the Beatles ever went off book, the actor's name is Wilfred Bramley. He would just kind of sit there like stone face. He was not up for improvising or like joke telling. He was also, I believe, in the closet. He contained multitudes, as we all do.
The scene before, like where he convinces Ringo to go out parading, I didn't notice this until last year. They screened this at just one of the theaters at the Grauman's at Hollywood and Highland. It was when the Get Back rooftop concert was in IMAX, and I was looking for screenings. And I was like, oh, they're showing A Hard Day's Night tonight? Like, I got to get in on this. And there were maybe 5 of us in the theater. Like, there was just no promo. But it wasn't until that viewing that I realized this brilliant little moment of comedy in the monologue that he's giving Ringo about, like, you got to be out parading, where he goes to put sugar in his coffee. The sugar doesn't come out, so he gets up, tries to get the sugar from a couple other tables, and as he comes back to the table, the waitress takes away the cup of coffee, and he sits down and goes to pour the sugar where there was none. Again, I've seen the movie like 50 times. I hadn't noticed that until last year. And it's so small.
I rewound that part. Because I was like, what is he doing? I was like, what's that man doing? And then I realized, and I was like, oh, that's really fun. That's really fun that they put that in there.
Or when they're doing I'm Happy Just to Dance with You, like, oh, why don't we do the show right here? And they do the song because they've brought all these all these girls. And I know we will have some things to say about the way that the Beatles are viewing women throughout this movie, but they like bring the girls down to the floor and then they're doing the song. And I'd always just watch the Beatles do the song. But in the background, you can see like the head makeup artist have to like corral them away and take them back up. I had never noticed it.
Wow. I mean, I didn't notice that. You will both have noticed way more than I did.
Let's rewatch.
You remind me of another part I liked that I had forgotten that I want to share. The part where there's just like a dance scene and the Beatles are really dancing. And then you think about like how the dance moves of the 60s are so much fun to watch and watch people do because they're so different from everything that came before. You know, like what came before this is like partner dancing. Like we're going to swing dance and we're going to foxtrot. And so like having a totally different kind of dancing that's like very alive and weird and jumpy.
Ringo has one move and it's just punching.
Yeah, but it was so fun. And it's fun to watch them kind of be in that habitat because we never watch the Beatles dance. We watch them perform. So it's fun to watch them in a club dancing and seemingly having a good time and kind of being away from the chaos of the outside world and just having this great moment indoors.
They were escaping doing their homework.
And they were doing it by dancing. I also forgot my next favorite moment I wanted to shout out, which was I loved when John, they have the measuring tape out and John comes back and goes, I now declare this bridge open. And he cuts it and walks away. And you're like, oh, that's
they cute. They shot multiple versions of that. Like there was another one that was like, I now declare this synagogue open.
I like that. You should have kept that one.
Representation.
I do have a question, which is the in joke that they reference in the film. Is it worth like discussing? Can you tell me about it? I don't understand it.
Is it where Ringo is reading Queen magazine and John yes. says something about he's reading the Queen? That's an in joke, you know?
I don't understand.
I have no idea.
Okay.
I do know that Paul is performing Hamlet nearby. Oh, that this too solid flesh would melt. Zap!
That was the only part they kept of his scene.
One of the actors who's in the opera that's also happening in the same building, he's like, now what on earth is that? And John looks at him and goes, my name's Betty. I don't know what that is either, but it's fun. There is one line in that scene, though, that kind of hurt, though. Where is it? Norm says, John, if you don't behave, I'll murder you. Like, oh.
Ooh.
And which comes after, like, I'll tell your mother of you. And for the listeners at home that may not be aware, John's mother was killed, hit in the middle of the street by an off-duty drunk cop when John was, I think, 16. So for there to be a line of like, I'll tell your mother of you. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, it's just dialogue. You know, the John of this movie maybe has a mother that's alive and well. But yeah, a couple lines of like.
Paul mentions his mother too. And she was also deceased. She died of cancer right. when Paul was 14. Because he has a line at the very beginning. It's like, well, my mom thought that I had to, you know, take my grandfather out to see the world, whatever the line is. And it's like,
but so far I've been in a train and a room and a car and a room and a room and a room.
Which is based on a line that John Lennon actually said, I think, to Alan Owen when they got back from their tour of Sweden. They led a very claustrophobic existence.
It's a bummer.
I want to bring a little bit of attention just to that little bit where grandfather's in the Baccarat Club. He's in the Sir Club for Champagne Baccarat Buffet. Because he's got next to him, he's got the busty lady, I bet you're a great swimmer.
I fucking hated that line.
Do you understand what the joke is?
Because she's got big boobs, so she must float.
She's wearing a long string of pearls. How do you get pearls?
I think it was a big boob joke. I don't think it's the pearls.
Okay, this is a Beatles movie for teenagers. I'm telling you about the pearls.
I think he's commenting on boobs.
It could be the boobs because when the Beatles find out where grandfather is and said, he could be in the middle of some orgy by now. They go, orgy, let's go. Now that actress is Margaret Nolan, who is James Bond's masseuse in Goldfinger, she wasn't the one that gets painted gold in the movie, but she is the one that got painted gold for all the ads.
So there you go. And it's a very Bondy scene. It's a very James Bond. We're around the Baccarat table. You know, I'm living my best James Bond life.
He dresses up as a waiter for 1 second to scam some money. And it's so, yeah. I think it's all one shot of him like looking down at the bill, putting the napkin on, walking over to the table. I think it cuts when he puts it down and then just walks right back. It's so funny.
Is there any other Beatles trivia or fun facts regarding this film that we should mention?
I mean, it led to the Monkees just like as a big, yeah, the movie came out and then America said, we have to have this, but on TV every week. And the Monkees were formed.
Wait, the monkeys were like the what the guy was talking about, the production corporate guy. He was like, oh, the Beatles are popular. Let's make another band, the monkeys. So it all ties in.
Yeah, so that was the mostly American Beatles as far as like the madcap, oh, getting into adventures and stuff. There were similar films based on the success of this with like Jerry and the Pacemakers. The Dave Clark Five had Catch Us If You Can.
Which is a very different feel. That movie is like dark and melancholy. It's not like joyful, happy like this one.
I think Paul Revere and the Raiders in the U.S. had something. They were just like, let's give a movie to a band. But a lot of them were more... like, we have a movie and a band is also here in a lot of the movie, but it's not really about it. But I will say this definitely led to Spice World.
Well, that was going to be in my double feature. That's in my double feature.
I was going to say that movie is a candidate for the Talk Classic to Me treatment.
Or like from Justin to Kelly.
Oh, shoot. Ooh. Sarah, that was not on my double feature list. I hadn't thought about that. We are now in the modern lens portion of this podcast. What holds up? What does not hold up? I can tell you some things that don't hold up. One, obviously, there are like no people of color in this film. There are some people of color that are fans, which is cool to see an integrated fan base in the 60s, but it's not like, you know, very prevalent. And there are like no people of color in this film. It's a very white film. And the roles for women obviously kind of suck, not just because there's like no actual roles for women. I think the secretary is the only like female speaking part, and she's a secretary, like not in a position of power. But I feel like obviously like the women are viewed kind of as objects, side pieces, decorative, not the greatest. It is a little creepy that they're hitting on schoolgirls. That's a little creepy. They're going to go pull some like 15, 16 year olds. It's a little creepy. I marked down Grandpa's line about the swimming. Fuck that guy. I think I just hate Paul's grandpa. I think I just like really despise him.
Well, and the thing is that Richard Lester doesn't like him either. I mean, he talked about, you know, in the materials that come on the Criterion Collection edition of the movie, they talked about like they needed some kind of, you know, obviously the film is going to build to a concert at the end, but they need some kind of ticking clock so it doesn't just feel like a series of vignettes. So that's like they all go running off and like, showtime is coming up 20 minutes away, 10 minutes away. And then they needed some kind of, you know, since none of the guys have love interests, like their love interest is really just themselves.
Which is fabulous.
But yeah. Like they needed some kind of tension, strife between them. So they have this interloper in the form of Grandpa. But yeah, Richard Lester was like, they shot so much more of that and they cut way, way back on what ended up in the final film.
Because he's frustrating. He's the villain. He's chaos. And it seems like for no reason, just for fun, you know.
King mixer.
But you're right. Oh, one more thing I did also shout out in my modern lens. George lost Susan her job. He should be more careful and not, you know, getting women fired. Oh, and the appropriation, which I also mentioned earlier, in terms of music and that happening in the music industry throughout forever. But positively, I love that the Beatles are challenging class systems. I love that there were no love interests in this story, that it was a story of friendship. That's really cool. Love the fashion in general, that holds up. And shout out to that fabulous director's mohair sweater. Oh my God, great, also piece of fashion.
I'd be remiss if we didn't mention Victor Spinetti at least once today.
I love him.
In all three of the Beatles live action, like narrative, if you can call Magical Mystery Tour a narrative, he does show up and it's sort of like, cool, he's here. Like, that's how you know it's a Beatles movie. Not because the Beatles are in it, because Victor Spinetti's here. He's so funny as just this like very uptight, neurotic, with a hair trigger, and the way he pronounces that. That's one of the best Paul moments, is imitating Victor Spinetti. Like, do you realize that we have 20 minutes? And Paul goes, well, yes, but we realized he must have come back. Yeah. But to the modern lens, I think the only other woman that there's like two reporters, but they're not like care. Oh, there's the woman in the hallway with John.
There is, yeah.
Anna Quayle. They bumped into each other in Australia years and years later, and John immediately recognized her, and they caught up.
In my mind, they just did the scene again, but I'm sure it was more casual than that.
Oh, yes, your nose is very.
Is it? Yeah, I stood up for you. Yeah, they don't give women a place in this. They do in Help. They absolutely. Yeah. So if we do a sequel to this,
that's probably why I liked him more as a kid without even realizing it.
they rectify a couple, though. Help has its own slew of issues when it comes to appropriation and race and things like that.
Oh, very much so.
So
also, I do want to say, I don't think it's necessarily the Beatles doing it. It's like the system, how people thought about things back then. It would not have occurred
the Beatles
to anybody.
Weren't thinking about this at all. There was some language in this that I was unsure whether or not. Like Norm, the manager, keeps calling them soft
sissies,
and I, you know, there was a couple things where he calls them sissies, and I, you know, I am not well versed enough to know, like, oh, is he like explicitly calling them gay, or is he just saying, like, which is not great, but to basically be like man up for whatever bullshit that's worth. So I was a little unclear about a couple of those things, but overall, there's a lot less like going like watching this compared to some other movies of the era.
Definitely. And I don't know what you're talking about with the way women are portrayed. He was just going off with her to see her stamp collection. Very innocent, clean fun.
I don't have a stamp collection.
So we are now in the double feature portion of this show. If you like this movie, what should you check out next? Obviously, the Beatles have other films, so you should check those out. Help, we mentioned, it might not hold up in a lot of ways. I don't know. It's about a cult. I don't know. We'll see. It's a comedy about a cult. So yeah, check out Help, but beware. It might not hold up with today's standards, but it's fun and it's the Beatles and the music is fantastic. I wrote down Spice World, obviously, as Jason had mentioned, very fun movie about a girl group that has a similar kind of sense of humor about it. There are Beatles documentaries, 8 Days a Week, Get Back, or two that came to mind. I also felt like this was very Marx Brothers-y, like Duck Soup was something that came up for me. And then Austin Powers, similar, like, you know, take on the 60s, and he's being chased by fans throughout the street, and it's very silly. So those were kind of the movies that I was thinking of. Did you all have any double features that you wanted to add?
For me, it would be That Thing You Do.
I'd love That Thing You Do.
To get, you know, it's an American band, but follows, you know, because Tom Hanks is such a huge Beatles fan, there are so many different things built into the career of The Wonders, the band in the movie, that mirror the Beatles in a way that isn't calling it, like, oh, we'll do what the Beatles did. They're just being a band that has, you know, this one song. It's longer, it's more dramatic. And I think gets more into the reality of what it is like to be that kind of, and it's not just like, wow, there's girls everywhere. This is wild. Let's do a show. It's like, oh, this is kind of taking a toll on our personal lives a little bit. But I think definitely is still fun enough to make it like a really solid double feature.
My idea for a double feature was to watch A Hard Day's Night with Dr. No. And if you want to make a whole day of it, watch A Hard Day's Night and Help, and then follow it with Dr. No, From Russia with Love, and Goldfinger, because all four of the Beatles were huge James Bond fans, and you will see how much stuff they stole from the James Bond movies and put into Hard Day's Night and Help. Like that whole scene with the Baccarat tables at the Circle Club. I mean, we already said it's James Bond, but like literally it's James Bond. Like you will, the very first time I watched Dr. No, I was like, oh, that's in A Hard Day's Night. And that's in A Hard Day's Night. And so is that.
There you go.
All four of them were huge. I mean, like Paul McCartney bought an Aston Martin because that's what James Bond drives in Goldfinger.
Ringo Starr married a Bond girl. That's from Love Actually.
He married a Bond girl. I've seen photos of George where he's wearing a t-shirt that says 007 on it. Yeah, no, they were all huge, huge James Bond fans. Once you see it, it's like, oh, I get it now.
All right. So now that we're at the end of the show, I do have to ask you, do you have a favorite Beatles album? And if you were a Beatle, which one would you be? Or just who is your favorite Beatle?
Oh my God. My favorite Beatle is John. And my favorite album is, I guess, Revolver, maybe. Today it's Revolver. Tomorrow it might be something else.
Only in this moment did I manage to think of this exact distinction. My favorite Beatle is John as a Beatle. My favorite person that has been in the Beatles is Paul. And I think that that's an important distinction, because really after the Beatles broke up, I, as a surprise to many people, way less versed in John's solo career as I am with Paul's or George's. But as far as just within that like 7 year recording span, it's John. It's John all the way. Favorite album today, I will say Revolver. I've got the little Revolver poster up there. And the big rainbow one in the corner is a like a grid of every single song and who plays what on each song. Though I can always return to Abbey Road and be happy as a clam.
Well, my favorite album is Help. I love it the most. It has my two favorite songs on it. I've Just Seen a Face and Ticket to Ride. Every song on it's a hit.
Very solid.
I love it. And it's right in that sweet spot in the middle. You know, it's like they're still doing rock and roll. They're a little experimental, but they haven't gone full like psychedelics. You know, we're right in the middle of the, we're in the sweet spot. That was my favorite one. I can't pick a favorite Beatle. It's hard. I mean, I think Paul is my favorite Beatle, but I think if I was a Beatle, I'd probably end up being the Ringo with the group.
A couple weeks ago, my girlfriend and I went to, every year Ringo does a little birthday celebration where in Beverly Hills, there's that big statue of his hand giving the peace sign. And the general public can just show up. You have to be behind the barricade unless you're, you know, in, but it's small enough and they have a sound system. So on Ringo's birthday, we got to like wish Ringo happy birthday. He was like 50 feet away on the stage. And the fact that, yeah, anybody will show up for a Beatles thing, but that Ringo, just for being Ringo, like he hasn't put out a like critically like well-regarded album in 30 years, but he's just so beloved by everybody that people are just going to show up knowing he's not going to sing or anything, but there's Ringo. Happy birthday, Ringo. It was just so, so beautiful.
I think also when you're a kid, he's your favorite one because he's the most like you. He seems the most like childlike. So I think it probably stems from childhood. Also, shout out to Rubber Soul. Also a great album. That's probably my second favorite. Great album. Okay, but we don't have to. We could do this all day because all the Beatles albums are great albums.
All of them. My pick is all of them.
So my two guests this week were Sarah Royce and Jason Burke. How can people find you? And do you have anything you'd like to share with us on the show? Obviously, that is not SAG-AFTRA. We're not going to, you know, promote anything that's adverse to the SAG-AFTRA strike rules.
I am a musician. You can check out my stuff at jasonburkemusic.com. Burke is B-E-R-K. Or Jason Burke Music on Twitter or Instagram, where I post far more than I do my actual website.
I don't really have an online footprint, but I am a TV producer. And I think that all the people who are on strike right now, I'm in solidarity and I hope you negotiate a realistic contract with AMPTP.
Yeah, I hope that we're able to have a middle class of writers again and actors. Wouldn't that be great?
Lovely.
All right. Well, you've been wonderful guests. Thank you so much for being here. And we will see you all next time on Talk Classic to Me.
You have been listening to Talk Classic to Me with Sarah Greenfield. That's me! My guests this week were Jason Burke and Sarah Royce. They will be featured on our Instagram page. If you enjoyed our show, please introduce a friend and show them how to subscribe, and maybe even find us on Spotify for Podcasters or Anchor.fm to become a contributing member to this show. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Talk Classic to Me for some awesome content and to find out what's coming up next. Thanks for listening.